let me just do this screen. Pretend there's an intro sound, graphic, whatever. This is going to be annoying for people who are kind of used to it. I accidentally messed something up, but that's fine. Anyway, pretend there's an intro. Now let's start. All right. Hey, welcome everyone. Happy Friday. Welcome to the Digital Cash, rundown. Episode 144, that's 144 weeks of doing this. So that's nice. It's been a while. And I'm joined by the one and only MJ. There's no other MJs in the world. You camped out on that name. How's it going, man?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
Pretty good. Thank you for having a good webcam and microphone. That's, you know, sometimes
I work remotely for a living, so I'm very dependent on it. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's good. I can tell you got like the real chair. I think I need a real chair. This point's just whatever, but
it's old at this point. It's becoming a little broken down on me, but it still functions pretty well.
Yeah, that makes sense. The gamer chair is like a serious move, but anyway, let me, before we get started on all the stuff, my Discord got kind of wrecked earlier or last Sunday, and so I'm still piecing it back together. Basically, some dude copied the browser token, login token, and logged into my account, and then just like banned everyone. And so I got rid of that. Unfortunately, it affected the Dash Discord as well. So they got that all sorted out. It was a bunch of pain in the ass.
Wow.
But and it's funny because I never like lost access to any of my accounts or anything. All my devices are pretty secure and everything. So just as soon as I woke up, I'm like, oh shit! And I just changed the password and the guy's out.
Okay.
So that was great. Could have been a lot worse, but. So as a result, all my people in my Discord got kicked out, and so now I unbanned them and now I'm getting them back in. So if you're out and you're watching this, let me know and I'll put you back in. So
I have not joined your Discord. I need to do that.
Yeah. Well, no. Funny you should ask. I might as well, I've been, I'll do that thing at the end. We'll get to that. Okay. So before we get into the news stories and stuff, obviously we got to hit on the Coin ETM radar thing. So, actually, I forgot to pull up. I need to get a little bit better about having the script on hand. But anyway, Coin ETM radar sponsors this podcast. And the thing is, I wasn't actually looking for any sponsors at all. I was just like, you know what? I'm just keep doing my thing, get the pennies, a dollar a day or whatever of YouTube ad revenue. And then they just randomly cold emailed me and were like, hey, we were going to sponsor this other guy, but he ghosted us. We thought, why not someone who aligns with our values? And I'm like, fantastic. So anyway, this podcast is sponsored by Coin ETM Radar. When buying crypto with cash, an ATM is much more reliable and safer than meeting some random person in a random place and, you know, getting shanked in a dark alley. Don't do that. And unlike an exchange where they can freeze your account, you truly own all the crypto you buy. With Coin ETM Radar, you can find crypto ATMs and other services where you can buy or sell cryptos for cash. On their website, you can search by coin, address, if the ATM supports selling as well as buying. You can also search by geo area, such as country, state, city, etc. And you can also check and compare actual current fees at the different ATMs, not just they post at one time, they're updated in real time. So go to coinatmradar.com, coinatmradar.com. So that's that little thing. And I have actually, I don't really do a lot of ATM stuff because I don't need to. But when I travel abroad, I do find it very valuable to find an ATM where I can actually sell some crypto for local cash. So I don't
have, for sure.
In case they don't have whatever. So it's been useful to me in the past for many years. So anyway. All right, so let's get to the first thing. ETF. Have you heard of this? Anyone heard about this?
What are you talking about?
It's kind of like the Jay Leno thing. Hey, so talking about ETFs. Anyone heard about this? You heard about this?
Yeah.
Just put up the Bitcoin Magazine tweet. Official SEC approves spot Bitcoin ETFs. So all the crypto space has been everything about that kind of stuff. So what's your, before I rant on this stuff, what's your hot take?
My take? Yeah, I'm kind of neutral on it, to be honest. I think a lot of the more digital cash oriented people in the space are pretty pessimistic on it, I think, overall. I don't see it as a terrible thing. I get the concerns with centralization and control over it, but I think generally speaking, it's not a terrible thing for more people to have access to it in one way or another. So I don't think Bitcoin really serves the purposes that it originally was intended to, or at least BTC Bitcoin does not. But I do think that in a way it's good to enable more access to these assets, regardless of really what that method is. I think there are better ways to access the asset, obviously, than through exchange traded funds. But I think it's good nonetheless, especially for generations and people who aren't so technically savvy today. I think we have a long way to come on the experience side of crypto still. And so enabling people who don't have that that experience or knowledge to have some way of getting into it, at least, I think we'll see a lot of people who get invested into it through ETFs, and then eventually kind of make their way to a more non-custodial approach to it. That's my hope anyway. So I'm in between. I get the concerns. I get a lot of the drama over it, but I see overall it having some positives as well.
Yeah, it's kind of funny because, I don't really disagree with anything there. I think that on the whole, it's a very positive thing, but the context is what adds some weirdness to it. Where it's kind of funny because also on the other side, because, in some cases, by some definitions, I'm as cypherpunk as they get, but some people on that camp are just super critical. So it is awful and stuff. It's like, listen, you grow something big enough and it's going to have, if everyone in the world was using this and no one was using banks, at some point this would have happened along the way. And then maybe 30 years later, ETFs aren't even a thing anymore because it's all decentralized or something in a utopia. But there's nothing wrong with it. At all. There's nothing wrong with, and I know a lot of crypto people who want to buy it, who own crypto themselves, but they just have retirement accounts, 401ks, things like that, that they can't, because of their employment situation or whatever, and that the tax benefits, they have to have it in the fiat world and they don't want it there. And so they're kind of parking it over there instead. So that part's great. The challenge is that Bitcoin is stagnated in so many ways that I would consider valuable, that the founding principles might maybe consider valuable, and that this has been the placeholder for that. And so Bitcoin is not ready for, I argue it obviously never would be ready the way it's been going for this kind of an outside institutional impact. So
too susceptible to manipulation. Is that kind of your biggest concern?
Yeah. Well, or the biggest thing is, it's kind of like having a custodial wallet take off as the number one wallet before a non-custodial wallet is really good to use. And so it's not that, it's just that you want to start one way. There will be custodial wallets. I hate to say it, it's true, but it's better to have that at come in at a later stage rather than now no one's going to go for the clunkier but more righteous path unless it's too late.
Yeah, you're right. And in a sense, you could see this almost as just a progression of that, right? Because we have seen a strong trend towards centralized custodial providers, wallets for Bitcoin. So I think, and that includes Lightning, obviously. So I think that with the Bitcoin community pushing these custodial solutions, it's almost like this was the inevitable solution, inevitable end to that. I think you're totally right on the concern over there being this strong custodial solution before there's really a feasible, non-custodial solution. I think that's a good point.
Yeah. Well, let's flip through some of these other posts. Just this next one.
Here's some other hot takes.
Post by the Bitcoin therapist, who's one of those awful maxi accounts that I like to dunk on.
I think
on
he
all
blocked
time.
Me.
Wow. How did you get it? I've been trying. I haven't gotten there. But he says the Bitcoin ETF isn't. It was a video of some guy talking to some pretty girl in a club. Clearly she's not interested, but he's just ranting in her ear. That meme template kind of thing, but it's like a video. And it says, the Bitcoin ETF still isn't priced in. A 10% drop is nothing. Plus Vanguard is blocking access from thousands of clients. The halving is still coming later this year. Trust me, you're going to need to buy the dip right now. Every single hodler this weekend. Which it is funny. It's also a little sadly true that that's where the mind share is at for Bitcoin.
Exactly.
But when we get
that's what you're going to see from maxis.
Yeah, I mean, it's okay to be excited about a thing. Like, if the U.S. government, let's just say, legalized a basket of cryptocurrencies for paying your taxes in. I mean, taxation is theft and all that good stuff, but like at the same time, everyone gets like a week to celebrate and just be like, look, we're not fans of the government. Some people might be, but this is a big moment for legitimizing and bringing real utility for the coin in the worst way possible. But like, let's be happy for a week and then just do something else. And, but unfortunately this is like, what do you have after institutions are coming? The funny thing though, I'm going to hit this lovely price chart, though, because it's a typical pump and dump, sell the news kind of thing. So I hit the price chart, right? Which I'm very unaware of most price charts, but like it was somewhere in the 44K. It was kind of 43,410, I think, on Sunday.
Yeah.
And then it pumped all the way up to like 47. And then it peaked out at 48. Basically 48.50, basically 48.5 grand on Thursday. And yeah, that was just like yesterday then. And then it just went, and now it's crashed all the way back down to 43. So 43 and
exactly
a half.
What you'd expect from the, you know, the by the rumors, sell the news. It's
So it's like a big
stereotypical.
Yeah. It's a big thing. And of course the drama that everyone who's watching this, most people watching this are very well aware of is the whole pump and dump, the whole SEC debacle around this, right? Where Gary Gensler said the SEC account got hacked when they tweeted. And apparently, according to Elon, I guess it was. Like, they did get their phone number compromised. They had no 2FA on it, though.
It was a very vague. They didn't really imply necessarily that it was hacked or I'm trying to remember the exact language they used. It seemed a little vague to me the way that X responded to it, and that it was potentially not necessarily external to the SEC that was the source of the, you know, invalid login. But yeah, very interesting. Do you buy it? Do you buy that it was some kind of actual hack? I mean, what about the timing?
I'm really thinking, because clearly they approved it.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think they changed their mind on approving it based on that. And don't really think they changed their mind on the timing either. Like, I just think that someone front ran it. Whether someone figured out they were going to and just hit it and just to do some. I don't exactly know. Yes,
that's all theory. I don't know if there's any merit to it at all, but I think right before the early tweet was posted, or early post was posted, there was, I think the SEC account had posted just the Bitcoin Cash tag and nothing else, and almost immediately deleted that. I don't remember who I saw posted about this, but so the theory is that potentially someone did get access to the account that shouldn't have in one way or another, shouldn't have had access. Posted that Bitcoin cash tag, and then went into the drafts and saw a scheduled draft to be sent out yesterday, and decided to delete their former tweet and repost that and post that other one early. I think that seems somewhat possible and would explain a lot of the timing around it, but it still seems very strange how the timing of the whole situation. You know, someone getting access to the account the day before they were planning an announcement. Very, very suspicious. I'll put it that way.
I don't really know what to think, but I do know one thing to think is tons of incompetence.
Like, exactly.
I get that you lose access to something and you can have chaos result, but this is a special kind of, you know, the special hell. Like, this is especially bad. I got to throw up the Bitcoin Magazine tweet. They put a meme of Gensler on the phone saying they bought. Dump it. And it's unfortunately exactly, you know, and it's funny, I even forgot that I commented on it. On the very top there is my tweet that says, you guys have been simping ETF nonstop for weeks, so kindly shut up. Which I'm not usually this rude in person, I should say, You have to be a little spicy to get that engagement on X. So, disclaimer.
Exactly.
I do believe what I said there, but
there's some clickbait there, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think it's hard to, I don't know, it's hard to fault them too much if this truly was some kind of hacking incident, but it seems like regardless, there was quite a bit of negligence involved with the SEC. So, yeah, I mean, it's just mostly, it showed very, very clearly how manipulatable Bitcoin and the crypto industry is, right? Because we immediately saw the impact. Like within hours, we saw massive impact. So, yeah, it's concerning. Again, like I said, as far as the ETF itself goes, I'm kind of neutral on it overall. But I think the SEC has not done a great job handling this entire situation, and not just with the post and all that, but just the way they've handled the crypto industry entirely has been a complete shit show. And
it's had like real casualties. Like obviously we saw the dip, but like people legitimately lost money based on the timing of this kind of thing. Not just because they because they gambled, but specifically because conditions outside of what should be expected did take place. So I put up on the screen, I found the tweet from this guy, Tom Case, whatever. I forget it, whatever they think. TK. He's in. I hope I don't get demonetized for swearing up a bunch quoting this thing. He says, "Fuck this, I'm out. I listened to it is all caps. This I listened to the Securities and Exchange Commission and longed Bitcoin using 100x leverage. Now I'm fucking liquidated again. I'm done with crypto for good. I'm never depositing just another 10 grand ever again. Fuck this fucking scam." It like I haven't vetted this, by the way, to make sure it's not like a joke post, because it could be. It could be. But it's pretty funny. And it is pretty funny, but also if it's true, it's very sad that someone is just like, I'm so sure I'm gonna like, you know, put all my
in on this.
I'm gonna go all in.
I'm not a big investor, which is I think kind of rare for people who are pretty active in the crypto Twitter world, but I don't invest a ton. It's not because I don't believe in the power of crypto. It's because I don't believe in the market. And I don't believe in the stability of this market in particular at this point in time. I think down the road, 5-10 years from now, I probably will become a bigger investor. I do have some, you know, I have some of my favorite coins that I like to actually try and use as much as I can. Mm-hmm. But as far as using it for truly investment purposes, I don't really do much of that. And yeah, it's just I think I try to warn my close friends and family that about my concerns with it, because I think that things like what we've seen with the SEC can cause significant damage. I have friends who have lost significant portions of their savings just because they invested in Bitcoin at the wrong time. And so, yeah, it's to me, I'm not a huge investor. I would never put all of my savings into any kind of crypto right at this point. But I can't say how much I respect you and others that are living the lifestyle of purely living on crypto, because that's to me is so scary. I think there's a lot of concern over stability in it, and so props to you and the others that do so. But you know, for myself, for my family, I'm staying away from it from an investment perspective for the moment.
Yeah, it is brutal to think about though, because and thing is, I've never approached this as an investor. I've never thought to invest. I just use, and maybe we're entering a moment where I might be able to think of stuff like an investment, but that's really almost scary to me, more scary than the way I live, oddly enough, because it just, that's the thing I have the most unsureness about crypto, because like I know how to use the tools, and I know when the tools change how to shift what I use according to those. Right. I need to figure that all out. But it just, when you invest, and like if you invest time and money learning something, you learn along the way if it's going to work or not, and you can pivot and don't have all that sunk cost of like learning something like the Lightning Network that's not going to work, right? I did run a Lightning Network, and I figured out pretty quickly I'm not investing any more time into this. And so, but with investment, you don't really know. You could be like, this is the best coin. It has all the things I want. And then it just, for any number of reasons, it doesn't go anywhere. And one of the things I do think a lot of people don't really give enough credit for is that if the founder gets literally hit by a car, at some inopportune stage, it's just, it's over, you know.
It can be disastrous, yeah.
It just could be all over. I mean, Satoshi obviously got things, got so much goodwill and stuff going and sort of set up a successor before moving on and like, you know, and then whatever. So that's kind of the and Charlie Lee sort of stepped away, but then still kind of there. And, you know, Fluffy Pony's not even the Monero founder, but the founder is gone forever, but he's the de facto founder, and he kind of sort of stepped away, but still there. And you got kind of a lot of those kind of things. If Vitalik got hit, I think Ethereum would do fine just now, but it would have some roughness from like the lack of vision kind of thing. And you could just go down the list. Bitcoin Cash is one of those few ones that, like, I don't know. I'm not super up on a ton of projects at this kind of level of depth, but I know Bitcoin Cash and Dash are interesting in this way, where Dash's founder exited 2017, and he hasn't been around. I mean, he's still, as far as I know, still alive. He just maybe had some mental health problems and stuff. He's gone.
Yeah.
And the key figurehead sort of left. The key figurehead after that, you know, basically got fired in 2022, I think. Like, the network just ran him out, said, "You're not doing a good job, get out of here." And there's no real figurehead. I'm kind of like a 50% figurehead, if you could, or 30% or whatever. But me and like the lead developer, like the more, but there's no like guy running the show. With the Bitcoin Cash world, it kind of went through that. Amari Sachet started it. You know, people get so mad when I say it's true, though. Bitcoin ADC. And then when Craig Wright and all of them forked off, one could call Roger Ver the de facto, even though it's very unfair of him to say that, because he didn't found it. He joined it later. He wasn't running any show. He just was an influential figure. And then
he became very influential. Yeah.
And then when ABC got jettisoned, and so then they fired the founder, the actual founder and founding team. And Roger he's around. He's just not, he still likes Bitcoin Cash. He just, as far as I'm aware, he's just not front and center. And so now it's like four different teams. I don't know who I'd call the person running it. There's a few devs that I've heard mentioned, but yeah, that's kind of the way the thing goes. But where did I even get into this crazy ramble? Oh yeah, about the investment part. Like it's so risky. Like, I think that I hate to say, look, this might be the spicy take in a reverse way of the show, but I almost think that the ETFs. Are like the only safe way to invest in crypto, because at least if there's an ETF, you know, there's enough institutional support behind it that it's not going to go down 90%.
It'll stay stable. Years.
Yeah. It'll be there for at least a few years to come.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good point. Yeah. Yeah. I totally agree. I think that's one of the things I love most about Bitcoin Cash is how decentralized that community really is. Not even necessarily from an operational standpoint, but from a development and just a general community standpoint. I think they've done an incredible job of trying to do as much as they can to decentralize the protocol itself and the community. And just seeing things like their, I'm forgetting what their protocol definition, their is it BIPs? No, it's that's Bitcoin. Chips.
Yeah.
Their chip protocol. Like, just seeing the progress with that and their reliance on that as their mechanism for driving change within Bitcoin Cash, I think that's awesome to see. And I think you're right in the lack of any kind of, at least any significant centralized point of control over the development and progress of the protocol itself. That's something that I think most cryptocurrencies should kind of strive for. And I think we obviously don't have that with BTC anymore. But I think, that's obviously the goal for most true cryptocurrencies that want to actually be decentralized.
Yeah, that's actually on the docket here. But I did this tweet that some people misinterpreted, because I don't know if you've ever seen the Maxi Derangement Syndrome account floating out there. It's a Monero guy.
Yeah, I think I follow him. Yeah.
And he talked shit about this tweet because he didn't get it at all. And I responded, he didn't answer, so whatever. But I just said that the Bitcoin ETF approvals show that crypto is going to succeed in spite of, not thanks to, government. If they really wanted to stop it, but it got too big too fast. Now their hands are tied. And I said, this is where the hater sentence, which is very you know, muted, but says, we need to get to do this with the digital cash use case. And it made it seem like the whole thing is very like positive about, oh, look at this ETF. It's so great. It's great. But the whole thing is like, let me find something to say that's accurate and doesn't just, because I shit on Bitcoin so much and I need to like not every tweet. So there, but
not without cause.
Yeah, the end is like, crypto's here to stay. It's doing great as far as like money, but like as far as the mission, a lot of ways to go. And so that's kind of the thing. And then let's get the digital cash use case. Let's get people actually using this stuff enough to where you can't ban that, because they can ban that and they are trying.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think about the mental impact that this will have on so many, not just institutional investors, but individual investors who are, you know, somewhat involved in the financial industry or others, that just adding legitimacy to the cryptocurrency industry. I think that's what this is doing. And, like I said, there's a lot to be concerned about with it, but I think it's kind of inevitable for any asset that's going to be, you know, striving to become any relevant on any global scale. There's going to be ETFs, there's going to be massive exchanges around it. There's going to be tons of industrial players around it. So it's not unexpected. It's not surprising at all to me. And I have some concerns, but overall, I think it's a positive. I think it definitely adds legitimacy to the entire industry. So I'm very positive from that perspective. I think your take is perfect.
Now, the negative side of the take, we go to the VanEck stuff, which I've already talked about this. I think the last show I talked about this specifically, but then there's been Bitwise came on board too. So the VanEck tweet says, we're not Bitcoin tourists at VanEck. We're in it for the long haul. That's why we made an initial $10K donation and signed a pledge to donate 5% of our Bitcoin ETF profits if approved. I mean, come on. How do you not get approved after you do that? It says, to support Bitcoin Core developers, and Bitcoin Brink for at least 10 years. Your tireless dedication, blah, 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 more details to come. And up there is Toby Cunningham. I don't know if you know Crypto Tips, but Sir Crypto Tips there. He says, there's no free cheese in the mousetrap, paying off developers to influence the direction of Bitcoin. Nice try, VanEck. I've been in this space longer than you guys have even heard of Bitcoin. You ain't fooling me. The problem is he makes it like, nice try. Yes, it's a nice try, and it's a successful try. Yeah. He's phrasing it like, you're trying like to do this. Like, no, they did it. And so I commented, and of course I got a bunch of, I'm sure I got a hate. I didn't check. Because now it's a fully captured asset. The next one is Bitwise. So Bitwise said, Bitwise will donate 10% of the profits of the Bitwise Bitcoin ETF, ticker BITB, to Bitcoin open source development. Recipient orgs, Bitcoin Brink, OpenSats, HRF. Bitcoin is important to the future. We're excited, blah, blah, blah. So this one's a little bit less, they're donating to a few different groups. It's all open source development. Anyone can donate. Why not a big company? What are your thoughts on this thing?
Yeah, I mean, again, I don't really care who it is per se. I just think that seeing any kind of active interest from major players like this means that we're seeing some legitimizing of it at a large scale, and I think that's overall a good thing. I think I'd like to see, like you said in your other post, I'd like to see more focus on the digital cash kind of side of this, but overall I think it's a positive. I mean, let's see, I was trying to find that post that you were reading from.
Bitwise one? Yeah, it's Bitwise Invest is the handle, and it's from January 10th. Bitwise, they posted that.
Okay.
That's their specific one.
That's their take on it, basically.
But yeah, you know what's funny is it shows a lot of like personal evolution in the space, because I'm thinking about 2015, 2016 me would have been like 100% positive on this. I'm just like, wow, look at this. They're growing.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And that was before I got acquainted with like Blockstream and all that. It's kind of crazy because back in the day, and it's just so weird that Bitcoiners don't acknowledge that this is like a historical fact, that Blockstream makes layer 2 solutions to problems they create, but that's a different story, right? And Blockstream was hiring the majority of Bitcoin developers or full-time developers at one point, and to where literally they were 100% on the payroll of Blockstream, and they were told just develop on Bitcoin Core. You don't do that on the side while you're working at Blockstream. You're just doing that. Like how, and you just don't understand the connections between that. And Blockstream, like they had some money, but like by today's standards, that was not a lot of money.
Right.
Like now we're talking about ETF profits of like of these giant financial institutions all throwing in. And it is an interesting question. And this is where I go back. This is my, concern with like, say, the Bitcoin Cash approach. And it's, I hope they're able, I'm rooting for them significantly to keep this good thing they got going, keep the band together the way that it's been going, a few different dev teams all working together and all being independently funded. I haven't looked into their funding sources, but I'm sure it's just community members and maybe some mining pools throwing them some stuff. But what happens once you start having institutions throw money at you like that? That's not a problem. It is a problem if they're throwing enough money that the interests of the other parties are not represented. Yes. So, you know, the golden rule is, of course, he who has the gold makes the rules. And so in Bitcoin's case, because of the overwhelming nature of the institutional funding compared to the other sources funding, it's 100% it's just a settlement custodial asset, and it was already moving that direction for years, but now this just puts the stamp on it, in my opinion. I don't know if you have a contrarian take.
I agree. You know my take on BTC in general. Of course. I've considered it captured for years, and see very little purpose that it serves today, other than speculative investment, which is a purpose. I should kind of clarify. I do see some purpose in people having a random speculative asset they can invest in and play on basically social sentiment, essentially, is all it is. I don't see it having any purpose, even as it's, you know, limited supply. I don't think it's going to be a feature. I think you made a great video on the concern over fractional reserves and general custodial solutions built on top of it. So I think it's essentially lost its limited supply narrative as well at this point. So I don't think, and I don't know how much of that is necessarily directly due to the capturing by Blockstream and other industrial investors, but I think as far as that asset, like, and for the problems that I want to see solved with cryptocurrency, BTC is essentially dead to me. And so, to me, I don't really care about the investment into that, and my only concern would be avoiding that happening in other currencies that I do hope to solve the problems that I want to see solved. So that includes Bitcoin Cash, Dash, Nano, and any others that are truly trying to solve that like digital cash problem. I think there's a real concern over like in 5-10 years, if these do blow up to the scale that we have today, if we have ETFs around those, are we going to see centralized investment? Are we going to see capture from an investment standpoint? We definitely want to try to avoid that if we can. I don't know the best way to do that. I think having decentralized development is a big piece of that from the start, right? So I think Bitcoin Cash is fairly well set up to avoid that, perhaps better than most others. But on the other hand, I see a lot of good that can be done by having centralized development and having a team of engineers that are truly experts in their field, that are truly building the best solution possible. That's something that can be really difficult to do in a decentralized way. And so I think there's like a really fine line, and part of it's timing of when, you know, if you can get the protocol to a point where it doesn't really need any more improvement, and then decentralize any further development or ownership of the project itself as much as possible after that. I think that you can avoid, hopefully, capture like we've seen with BTC. But I completely agree with your takes that I've seen around kind of the investment concerns over BTC development, and which if there really isn't a whole lot of BTC protocol development these days, but the investment is mostly going into secondary solutions and other kind of custodial and financial industry investments into it. So my hope is just that we get to the point where the protocol of whatever currencies do end up working long term, we get to a point where they're as decentralized as possible before that capture can happen, I guess is my main
hope. I guess like if you're going for the you know, figure it out yourself funding route, I think you'd have to get a good launch going where you basically say, okay, look, we need a bunch of money to get this out the door at least. And why don't we get, seed donations of however many companies will be profiting the most off of this technology. Like, for example, if they're like, do they send payments? Do they need that? If it's a payments thing, then you just get, and you just make sure that there's enough that aren't connected. You kind of like get a group. You get an initial group and just say, we all get this much, and then they commit to a certain amount, you know, or they commit to a certain amount of funding, and then they also commit to having like a usage donation to developers kind of thing. Like, click here to send a thing to the whatever, that kind of deal. And they just set the precedent going forward. And so,
I mean, it's just, I would love to see that.
Yeah, and then any new entrants, any new companies that do new wallets and stuff like that, it's kind of set in the culture that people are not going to band around this wallet unless they do the same. And then you just sort of like try your best to keep it as decentralized as possible from the sources of funding. It is very weird because, so like ThorChain, the Maya protocol, those kinds of cross-chain AMM DEXs have like an affiliate thing built into the swaps where you can just do the swap straight, like just send it to the network, do it all yourself. But if you're using an interface, they add a, it's kind of like a referral code to the end of it that then the swap partner, like Trust Wallet's making like money hand over fist on their ThorChain swaps. And so that kind of led me to explore that apparently that's doable in Bitcoin and Bitcoin-based cryptocurrencies to do like a per transaction fee in the wallet. Now, apparently, from my very preliminary research, Bread Wallet, which is one of the oldest, easy to use like Light wallets, did do this at one point, and then, but they were fully open source, and so people just cloned Bread Wallet without the fee and started doing that, and then Bread Wallet just got rid of it, and then no one did that ever again.
Yeah.
And so it's very interesting, a very interesting study in how you can set the precedent for how things are going to go in this ecosystem.
Yeah. Have a standard for this, a social standard essentially for what's expected of tools and applications. Yeah. I see you did there. I think this sounds very similar to what you're describing, but I think having, you know, just in every wallet, just an option to an opt-in donation of a percentage of your transactions. You know, I think a lot of people like us probably would be pretty happy to donate a small percentage of all of our transactions to the team behind whatever tools we're using, if we find them valuable. So it being opt-in would be a big piece of that. Like like you said, making that the standard and the expectation is that, you know, we can have, so like obviously with, you know, Nano, there's no fees built in the network, but if wallet providers made an opt-in option for sending a percentage of your transactions to a donation fund, then I think that'd be a potentially good thing. I think it's important that it remains optional though, right? And I think you want to avoid any kind of barrier to entry for any users. And you know, my extremist view on fees and things like that, but I think it's, I guess if we're really trying to get to as many people in the world as possible, fees have to be optional. I think we need to minimize any additional costs from the actual transaction values as possible, and remove any of that as possible, so that or as much of that as possible, so that there's no barrier for anyone with fees or anything like that.
There's a funny thing, and I have to actually look into this a little bit more, but the whole concept of, this is something I've thought about a whole lot, right? Because everyone pays in something for stuff that happens that they want. And sometimes it's paying through, like if it's a, like for example, I am paying nothing to heat my house this winter. I'm not paying any money because I chopped a hell of a lot of wood this year and I'm just running off of that. But it's not free. It's just like I found a way, like, oh, I like to go outside and get a little exercise. And it's like, it's part of gym time. I've done explicit like calisthenics or weights or anything very little this last year because most of it was like chopping and stacking wood in addition to, you know, training on the side. Right. And so, but I it cost money. It cost stuff that, you know,
well, time and effort.
I could have just paid for it instead. So you can't get around that. But the whole fee conversation is very much a packaging conversation almost, where like, a lot of, it's kind of interesting where you have a lot of AI companies starting to do like a credit thing. Like they're paying, they're charging, it costs this many credits to do this many generations or whatever. And whereas then in the past, the old model is like a subscription model. Or even before that, the super old school model is you buy the software and then you own it.
Yeah.
And so it just blows my, like I used to buy things and like,
yeah,
it just blows my mind that like, you know, $400 for an office suite or some like Adobe Creative Suite, you buy, oh my gosh, like who does that?
Yeah.
And so yeah, but it's funny because it all amounts to the same thing at the end of the day. It's just that which is the packaging that works best for, you know, for users. And I think it's very interesting that in the early days, like I think we're well past Bitcoin today as far as, you know, Bitcoin was a great innovation in 2009. And, you know, we're on to like so many other things as well. But there's so many things we need to learn from those early days. Like, for example, Bitcoin used to have a certain portion of the blocks were for zero fee transactions. Like they had zero fee free transactions. Just to like, oh, there's always room for people to be messing around. And the way Bitcoin scaled for Bitcoin, I don't think those days are ever going to come back. Or even maybe Bitcoin Cash today could do some of that. But then I do remember a few years ago when we were talking about like Dash Evolution and stuff, the guy who used to run the core team who got fired for whatever else, but he was talking about getting rid of transaction fees peer to peer or getting rid of transaction fees entirely, basically, but, you know, pushing them onto the merchant. So if you buy from the merchant, just like in the traditional system where the merchant pays and peer to peer transfers are free. And I don't exactly know this. Maybe that was just conceptual, like talked about rewards points and stuff too, like for credit cards. And I mean, that was clearly more of a conceptual concept, but I have to go back and ask some people that were closer to the core team at the time or whatever, who can know exactly the technical mechanism he's talking about. But for example, you can sign over a transaction to a like if you use a BIP70 invoice, right? You can use that right now where you sign the transaction, give it to the merchant broadcasts it. I think you could do that in a way that they pay the fee anyway. So you could keep.
Yeah.
So as far as like the fee structure of who pays for what, I'm sure there's ways of making sure it's zero fee to the end user, even in systems that don't explicitly have that. And that's like a UX kind of a thing almost.
I think the problem is if fees are leveraged as a way to fund the cost of the mm-hmm. network, and if the network has significant costs, right? So I think a big difference in high fee networks versus low fee networks is just the operational costs. I think that's all it really is, right? Mm-hmm. We've seen different levels of security based on the different operational costs of the network. We've seen that BTC now has insanely high hash rates that need to be paid for. And the question, like you said in one of your recent posts, was like, it's a matter of who's going to pay that and why. And I think in traditional systems that have fees as a mechanism built into them, that's going to end up falling on users to some extent through either inflation or fees, right? Mm-hmm. So I think part of the problem is just understanding why there is a cost to operating the network. Why does the network have a high or low operational cost? And where does that cost get paid, like you said? Mm-hmm. If you can bring the operational cost down to a point where it makes sense from a financial perspective to provide the service despite not getting fees from the users, regardless of kind of how you're funding your mm-hmm. operation on the network, I think it's just the bottom line is just going to be, what is the operational cost of the network? What does it cost any service provider to mm-hmm. provide that service? And how are they going to fund that or find the incentives to cover that cost, right? So
yeah,
I think it comes down to like whether or not that mechanism exists at all mm-hmm. and whether it will be leveraged or not. I think in traditional proof of work chains, we've obviously seen a combination of fees and inflation used to offset to fund that cost. And with the diminishing cost on the block side, block reward side, those fees become the sole source of funding. And yes, you could rely on, you know, companies and service providers to cover those fees for you, for end users. And you could do things like having a signed transaction that is handed over to the service provider or something like that. But the bottom line is that cost still exists and needs to be covered, right? And by removing that cost as much as possible or minimizing that cost as much as possible, you remove the need for there to be that cost at all, right?
That is an important
point. That's my perspective.
That is an important point. And I know Justin Bonds made that when he was talking about why he favors proof of stake now as opposed to proof of work. Is the with when his perspective was proof of work, if it's worth paying for, if it's worth paying for it. Like if this is, there's nothing wrong. I mean, if it provides value and this is how you get the value, absolutely do that. But since he's not convinced it's the best way of getting decentralized security, it's like, well, why waste all that money? Because if you think about from a capital allocation standpoint, if you have a mining farm, you allocate a significant amount of money into capital that is not very liquid, which is the equipment. But then on top of that, you have this upkeep fee, the electricity fee, and also physical storage fees, which compare those with like security of staked funds, for example. There's a lot of nuance in a lot of that, and of course you do have capital sunk cost, like allocation, like opportunity cost in staking, but you also have that in mining, and mining you can't get that back. But just the burn rate, the electrical burn rate, it's something that if you can find a way to not have, it's great. You know, why wouldn't you? Because that just, if you could afford to have, let's say, free transactions, if you're running a proof of work based system, you now have free plus then this burn rate that you have to pay for. Yep. And then that's where that comes in. So ultimately, I think that a Bitcoin and even like Bitcoin Cash people are talking about, you know, it's going to be cheap at a high level. It's like, but it could be cheaper if you didn't have to burn the electricity, or you can do burn some of it, but less of it. If you just all your security is that, then that's just, it's an inherent, I would say, and I'm not even saying it's a bad thing necessarily, although, you know, maybe we could argue that it is, but it's an inherent inefficiency from a cost standpoint that, you know, proof of work people argue is worth it, but it's you can't argue it's not there.
Right. And I think it was in your post actually that you mentioned what is the point of decentralization if or the cost of attack, right? From a 51% attack type of attack. What is the point of that cost if you're so centralized due to your mechanisms that you don't actually have to expend that cost to attack because you can attack indirectly through the few centralized points of control over the network, right? And I think when you look at the whole debate over proof of work, proof of stake, or any other mechanisms of those sorts, you have to understand what the purpose is of those. And the purpose is symbol resistance, right? So the entire purpose of proof of work is to have a decentralized or kind of randomized way to choose a leader who's generating the block into a randomized way. And it's not truly random, but a somewhat randomized way to issue the asset. And then as a incentive for people to join the network, right? That's because it kind of the three primary points in really proof of work, proof of stake. Their sole purpose is to provide civil resistance for that mechanism, for those mechanisms. So if you look at that and you understand, okay, well, if we're trying to provide civil resistance and that's all we're trying to do with proof of work, proof of stake, then let's just look for the option that allows for the best civil resistance with the lowest cost. Right. Mm-hmm. And I don't think proof of work is that. I think we've seen inherently that it doesn't give great decentralization because it has centralizing trends due to economies of scale, due to recurring return on investments that can be introduced to the network. So we see this creeping trend towards centralization. And I think you have to understand proof of work itself isn't a security mechanism. It's a mechanism for civil resistance to make sure that you don't have anyone that can just spin up a bunch of nodes to take over the network, right? So essentially, it's a protection from 51% attacks through decentralization, through civil resistance. And yeah, I think there's the argument over, you know, whether or not proof of work is the best solution for that is kind of silly because we're seeing in the real world, the real results that it causes centralization. We're seeing Bitcoin down to two pools being in control of more than 50% of the network. And I know there's all the argument over, oh, well, the miners contributing to those pools can decentralize. I'm not satisfied with that. I don't think anyone interested in true decentralization should be satisfied with that, because that's retroactive. You know, you're assuming that decentralization can occur after the point of an attack, which, mm-hmm. look, if we're trying to build a real system to provide a economic foundation for a global economy, we can't rely on a system that's dependent on reactive decentralization, yeah. and reactive security.
It is interesting. Like, this is on the very surface, not a very complicated topic, but it's incredibly complicated when you go in the weeds, because one thing that proof of work, it's kind of funny because there's not a lot of nuance about security in proof of work specifically, because, you know, there's like, what do they call it? Like 51% attack deniers. I don't know if you ever met any of those. There are some that said they say that it's literally not real. And even some Bitcoin Cash people I've seen talk about that. But it's not, the reality is, it is absolutely real and it's a real threat. But what it does is not necessarily, so first of all, if you do a temporary 51% attack, you basically just prevent transactions from being sent or just reverse those ones.
And so people,
but it's not even like you just try again when it's done, kind of thing, right? When the chain realigns. So it's it's not like you control the network now. Now you can do everything with it, really. You stop transactions from happening for a period of time. If that's what you do, you might, like, if that's literally you could selectively 51% attack, by the way, where you could just process all the block, all the transactions, include all this stuff. But then on this chain, these certain UTXOs, you just don't
exclude certain UTXOs. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that's one common rebuttal to the concern over 51% attack. And I think I haven't seen it as a 51% attack denier, but I think I have talked to, you know, interact with people who have taken that stance essentially. And one common rebuttal is they might be able to censor transaction, but eventually a node's going to accept it, right? Or a miner's going to accept it. And also the fact that it'd be really difficult to sustain an attack, a censorship attack with 51% for an extended period of time. That's fine. And I agree with that to some extent, but you don't necessarily have to have an extended attack to cause significant damage, right? If again, if you have a global economy built on top of this asset, and you have even for 20, 30 minutes a day, an attacker censoring the chain, it could lead to some serious fallout and some detrimental effects
on the global economy. Twice a year, there's a day when everything, that's enough to just cause so much capital flight from that. Just so much. Yeah. Now, proof of stake or stake-based systems, broadly speaking, are much harder to attack, much more expensive, all that kind of stuff. Although, on the other side, the attacks might be, I wouldn't say more fatal, but they're more, because if you get the majority of the stake, you basically kind of run the network. And then that gets, if there isn't some slashing mechanism, like make sure, which slashing is not as controversial in and of itself. But if there isn't something like that, then that can become a real problem, right?
Yep. Totally agree. And I think it's critical that anything that's using proof of stake as that civil resistance mechanism, I think it's important to consider kind of the possibilities for reaction to an adversarial member. Mm-hmm. But I think if we can focus on building a truly decentralized network from the beginning, you can essentially make an attack through acquisition of the asset nearly impossible. I think, potentially someone could gain a controlling share of a proof of stake network. But if there's a mechanism for slashing or for forking them out of the network in some way, that's almost a non-factor. But my hope would be that the network could be decentralized enough ahead of time, could be large enough where it'd be nearly impossible for anyone to even obtain a controlling share of the network, right? Mm-hmm. If we can build a network that has a default state of decentralization so strong that it would be nearly impossible for someone to even obtain enough stake to take control of the network, I think that'd be the best case scenario. But I think it's critical to take into account the need for some kind of slashing or forking mechanism to remove any adversaries from the network. And that's something that I think a lot of networks aren't doing the best job of yet, but hopefully will as we grow this industry. But
One thing that's interesting also is the Monero approach, which is, maybe you could say, Digibyte is similar in this way. Maybe you say that, because basically there's two camps of proof of work, the ASIC and the non-ASIC camp. Mm-hmm. And I would say that's a full philosophical camp because there's ASICs in both, but actual ASICs in both. But I guess the point is if you have an algo, someone will build specialized hardware that works for that. And if you have an algo that, like, you can change it every once in a while. Thing is, if it's a centrally controlled, who decides to change the algo? Like when the Monero team decided to change the algo, it split into several different Monero forks. And they all pretty much died off. So it's not like, it's kind of a little bit of a non-issue. But the point is to be able to, ability to do that is a centralizing factor. The thing is, if you're ASIC resistant, you're trying to be like individual miner or whatever, you have what I would probably call a great decentralization in that, to a certain extent, in that the people running the network, getting the coins, all that kind of stuff, anyone can do it. And it's really hard to stamp it out. Like you take down not mining farm, this other guy spins up some more here. And it's very fluid, very hard to stand out. It's very good for like adversarial situations at that level, at the small level, underground darknet kind of level. Then at a certain extent though, the problem with that approach is, first of all, unless you keep changing the algo, you will get ASICs and it's always going to happen. Or if you don't get ASICs, the problem is the thing with ASICs, which Bitcoin, I don't think is very vulnerable to attack right now. Like the odds of a 51% attack happening on Bitcoin's chain ever in the future history of the coin are almost zero or very low, I think.
It'd be very difficult.
Guessing that it's not going to happen because no one's going to acquire that much very specialized hardware and sink all that money into just trying to stop this network when an algo change or like a fork, like it's going to be hard to just, you don't own the network now. You disrupt it and cause some issues, but then, you know, it's not going to go anywhere and Bitcoin's still going to be around probably. The thing is, what you can do though is start like co-opting the large mining pools and just say, filter these transactions or et cetera, et cetera. Now, on the other hand, if you have an ASIC resistant kind of world where everyone's doing their home mining or whatever, you keep that up. Now you can still 51% attack the network. The problem is it's a lot easier to do that now because, the cost to attack probably goes significantly down. Although if you have let's just say somehow you got a super widely adopted, super valuable network that was just still at the home mining stage, you could keep that going. But what happens is if it's ASIC resistance, that means you need non-specialized hardware to attack it, which means you don't actually lose that sunk capital cost in buying specialized machines for something you're trying to destroy. You can just, when they change the algo, you could keep on attacking it and disrupting it. And so that's the kind of trade-off on that level. And that gets a little sketchy, but I guess it depends on your approach to that. You know, if it's, if you are trying to be like really against adversarial, like are you trying to be stamped out every moment?
Yeah. Like I said, I think, proof of work from a purely cost standpoint is great. Like it creates a tremendous cost to attack, and that's good. But the problem is that it creates indirect opportunities for attack because of centralization, right? And when you have two mining pools in control of the network, if either of those mining pools are susceptible to any kind of compromise or seizure potentially, or not the pool, but any major minor mining companies or anything like that mm-hmm. Are major contributors to the total hash rate. If they were to get compromised by the government in some way, or captured by the government in some way, or compromised in other ways, it completely negates the cost, right? So, and again, it'd be tough to sustain any attack even in that way indirectly. But I think just the fact that you're not getting decentralization that is the most core fundamental protection of these protocols, I think that's where the focus should be. And I think this goes back to the video that you made yesterday on, you know, what should the primary goal, primary objective of these protocols be? And I think it needs to be on that tab. Yeah, go for it.
Just show. No narrative is more clearly shaped. I don't want to. It's too early to play that the whole thing. But just basically, I made a video that I wanted to have out way earlier in the week, but I was up and I got it out like 11:30. It got posted past midnight last night, but whatever, it's good. Just a quick 10-minute video on like everyone needs to run a node. That idea that has shaped crypto so much and has caused, in my opinion, a lot of damage. And so, yeah, that's just kind of the bookmark on that. But yeah, the thing about the node, that's a different thing. The node isn't even base level security. The node is just how people interact with the network. And I think it's so weird because as a node runner myself, right, I've run quite a few different crypto nodes over the years, including a Lightning node. And I think it's good. It's desirable if you can, but the thing that baffles my mind, which is why I kind of got to this, is people keep on saying we need everyone to be able to run a node. There are literal real world Bitcoiners who run a node, but do not transact with it.
Yeah.
And that to me that's how you know it's upside down. It needs to be like, I understand there's different levels of like, everyone does this. Some people do that. Very few do that. But if it's just like, and I understand you want to do all, like almost everyone uses, almost everyone runs like almost head to head with those things. But when you have like an inversion where more people run a node than can use it, that is, that's insanity.
Defeats the purpose, right? Completely defeats the purpose. And I think it comes down to, yeah, so this was the entire point of contention in the block wars back in 2017 era, right? So it was, should we increase the capacity of the network at the cost of fewer people being able to run nodes, or should we minimize the cost of running a node so that anyone can run it, but keep the capacity of the network very low? And I think people had this misconstrued conception of what decentralization means and why it's important, right? So I think most of the BTC camp, the small blockers, had this idea that the decentralization was about making sure that there can be as many copies of the network as possible, that there can be as many nodes in the network as possible, when really the control is over centralization of power. And making sure that as many people as possible can run a copy of the network, essentially, doesn't guarantee any decentralization of the power. And I think that was the main debate over the block size wars. And I think that still stands today. And you see people who claim that because Bitcoin nodes can be run by just about anyone, that it's the most decentralized network. And I just think that completely flies in the face of the entire intent behind decentralized networks of any kind, really. But especially with cryptocurrencies, where we're talking about control over the ledger with the network, essentially, the control over who can write to the network and what goes on that ledger. So I think, I think there's a larger conversation to be had about like, what does decentralization mean and why is it important to these networks? And I think that was the point of contention in a lot of the previous debates, and still currently a big argument. And I think that's the heart of what your post was about, your video yesterday. It's like, what does decentralization really mean? Why do we need it? And is ensuring that everyone can run a node, is that really decentralization? I don't think it is.
Yeah, there's actually this is a highly evolved topic at the, in the very beginnings of it is absolutely not. It's just a very simple thing. It gets more involved. My former neighbor was a university blockchain researcher. And so when they published something for Arizona State and went out to the like celebration party and stuff, I got to pick his brain a lot on how this stuff works. And node counts do make it harder to scale on chain because of block propagation, because when you get a block just sent out to everyone, the further in the reaches of the network it gets, it has latency. So the early, I think like 2016 era blockchain scaling things from Bitcoin Unlimited, I believe, they had like a 1 or 2 gigabyte block, and the propagation times were close to 10 minutes. Now the block interval's 10 minutes, which means you're just this close to like having a block get out there and it's already too late because it's time for another one. And so, and they, I think they had something like 10 to 20 nodes during that experiment. So that was kind of an upper limit, but then what happens when you hit the thing that people don't realize is people just think that that's like gospel. Like, that's it. You can only have this much of a block with this many nodes. That's terrible. So we could only realistically scale to 100 megabytes in order to have the amount of nodes that we think is properly decentralized, which again has not been quantified. It should be quantified, by the way, but it's not. But the reality is when you hit that, then you have engineering problems that you could solve. And so, for example, Bloom filters, so you can only, each node only requests, they just request, not can I have all the transactions on the network, but can I have all the transactions I don't already have? And the Bloom filter selects just those and sends it to them. And then like, okay, well, there's like Xthin, I think, was the more recent block propagation protocol. I'm sure they've, this is in the Nakamoto systems, right? I'm sure they've advanced past that, but basically ways of getting the blocks out with as few orphans and as little latency as possible. You can get quite good at this. And then I think the superscalers at the point today, I mean, BSV, I don't really count BSV 100%, and I know BSV people are going to get mad at me for this, but it's because I don't think that there's a realistic connection between what is a transaction and what are you trying to do with throughput. And so you have like a giant block that like in like 10 nodes or something at, let me actually, 10 might not be far from the truth. Maybe I should actually
look at it. It's something like that. I mean, how many nodes are significant is a bigger question, and that's very few.
Yeah. It's so it would just like a very couple, and there's, I haven't really looked into too many of the other problems, but like, for example, Solana does a ton of transactions, and I think that they have very relatively few nodes. I know that one of the sleeper innovators in the crypto space has been Cosmos, where I haven't really, like, you start to notice, like, everyone claims they have the best shit, right? But you start to notice something's significant when you have copies. Not specific, like, copies, but when you have people deriving work. So Bitcoin is obviously an innovator because there's endless Bitcoin-based cryptocurrencies out there. Ethereum, also innovator, tons of ones like that. And then there's not a lot of Monero ones, let's be honest. There's, like, a couple, but, like, mostly it's, like, Monero's not there for, like, the tech. It's more there for, like, the vibe, right? As far as, like, you know, always on soup. Rawls on privacy, super hardcore, hard to stamp out, all this stuff. The ring signature stuff is interesting. I've seen it in a few different projects, but it's not really, it's not like zero knowledge stuff with Zcash, right? Where that is like out there.
True.
And then of course, there was a whole lot of coins with masternodes after Dash, a lot of DAOs after Dash and stuff like that. And a few instant transaction stuff, which blows my mind. There's like a few and it's not everything, but that's a different story. And then with Cosmos, I didn't even know what Cosmos was until the last couple of years because I didn't need to care. There's some Polkadot. There's another. Okay, whatever. Like, how do I keep a track of all these things? But a lot of coins have been Cosmos based. And the big ones, of course, that I think of off the top of my head, of course, are Thorchain and the Maya protocol and all those others that started with this whole IBC system. And then, of course, Dash's data platform is loosely Cosmos based now. And there's just a few, you can start to see it everywhere. And Cosmos, basically, I think they have some, like, those types of nodes, at least from my knowledge from, like, Thorchain and Maya, have, like, around, like, 100 nodes that are very high throughput and churn in, where there's, let's say, 200 or, I don't know, let's just say 150 potential nodes that are qualified to be nodes, and then just every so often a new set comes in out of that that qualifying group just to keep it kind of decentralized. But it's also 100, I guess, is a good enough group that you get
So is this, are you saying this is the conclusion kind of that you've seen from players like Cosmos and others, is that 100 seems to be like a good balance, or is that your personal conclusion?
I'd have to do actual research into this as opposed to just like winging it, but it does. I think 100 seems to be a minimum. Like, I don't think you want to go below 100 typically. And of course, what is a node? Like, is it, if it's really hard to access, like, because for example, Thorchain nodes cost many, many millions of dollars to bond, I think. So those are heavy actors. And so if you have 100 of those heavy duty actors, that's, I would say, quite decentralized, because it's not like 100 Litecoin nodes or something, which is like, nah, I could run 100 Litecoin nodes if I wanted to. Yeah. And so that's something significant. It does seem also, it's like there's a very difference, very big difference in throughput between, or necessary throughput between use cases, because data is constant. Like there's constant transactions of people constantly clicking, clicking, clicking. Like if I put my X posting on a blockchain platform, if all that was done on a, it would be hundreds and hundreds of transactions a day. Now, I have to admit, I have not, I will be making some payments today, but I have not made a single payment yet today on a blockchain network. It's, you know, I might not have even done it this week yet, because I've just been so busy just like doing stuff, and like I already have my coffee at home and stuff like that. So I haven't, so it could just be like a few payments, like fewer than one transaction a day, depending on the day, could be my average for payments. But for data, I could hit up 1,000, well over 1,000 over the course of a week. So different use cases, right? It's definitely not like, you know, you, it, obviously different decentralization things. Like then there's also the concept of data pruning of, I think Solana, I mean, I need to research Solana.
That's more for storage than anything else. But yeah, I think generally speaking, you know, we're talking about throughput, and I think like you alluded to earlier, kind of filtering as much of the network traffic as possible is a big piece of that. But there are protocols, and I think you were talking about how things that prove successful get copied, and either directly through forks, things like that, or indirectly through you know, copying of the mechanism or protocol into other protocols. And so with Hedera Hashgraph and Nano, and I think a couple others as well, they use something called gossip about gossip, which is essentially a way to minimize the amount of traffic in the network by essentially when nodes communicate with each other, they're not just communicating individual updates on the state of the network. They're also communicating what they know about who else has received that communication. And so you have a basically logarithmic kind of performance on this, because you don't need to relay the same message ad nauseum throughout the network. It doesn't have to be distributed that way. It can be distributed in a package form, where when one node is communicating with another, it already informs that new node of other nodes that are aware of that information. So you get this kind of exponential propagation that's much faster than traditional, you know. So traditional gossip propagation is exponential itself, but this is a level of kind of rate above that even. So there's things like that that I think we are seeing, and I think there are several other networks that use that approach as well. I think Lehman Baird of Hedera was, I don't know if he's actually the creator of that protocol or not. It may have been Nano. I don't know, to be honest. But things like that can really help to increase bandwidth without the need for much more powerful nodes, right? Because you don't necessarily need, you can get through process efficiencies, you can get throughput and optimizations that you wouldn't that you don't necessarily need hardware to provide. Now, hardware is always going to be the most fundamental way to scale a network, right? Through to improve the capacity of the network. Now, there's some protocols that have their own limitations on throughput or capacity that kind of are the bottleneck themselves. Like BTC is the most obvious example of that, where the protocol itself is preventing the scalability. But generally speaking, if you remove those types of limitations from within the protocol, then it becomes about optimization of the processes of the communication between nodes and reducing network traffic as much as possible, as well as just scaling the hardware and the actual network between the nodes, right? So improving the internet communication between those nodes can help significantly as well. So I think it's not always a matter of the cost, the value, size or cost of each individual node in the network. It's also about the protocol itself and removing any inefficiencies within that.
Yeah, that's also a thing where like the ability to access a network, how you use that could vary on some things. And that's one thing that became very, I guess, a big stumbling block for Ethereum has been the fact that in order to access the network, you needed to run some pretty expensive full nodes. And so most people would do that through some sort of a third-party provider, like MetaMask with Infura and things like that, and then they became like censorship vectors and other things. There's something that Dash is working on called a DAPI, or decentralized API, so you could not run a full node and kind of access the network in at least the platform functions from a client side without needing, you know, without needing to actually go through a node in the interim. But to a certain extent also, SPV, simple payment verification, which is one of the most old school things, it's like super old. It reduces a lot of the trust when having a light. So you still need to connect to a node, but you connect to like a few and you only trust them for a certain amount of things. And you basically run your own like stripped down node to a certain extent, even though it's not a node. And it's not the same as like, oh, you just need to connect a node and everything the node tells you is gospel. Like, it's not quite the same like that. But as I cracked down in the video about like, if you're using the Lightning Network, you're very hardwired into a lot of these systems. And like a forced close, from what I'm told, is like you have to wait a couple weeks, I think, before you can access those funds again. Like if you...
That would make sense. That's the penalty window, or whatever they call it. So that would make sense.
Yeah.
That's scary. That's horrible. I can't imagine having to wait 2 weeks. I mean, Lightning has a tremendous number of problems. I think it's essentially dead in the water at this point, in my opinion. But yeah, that's one example of the many technical problems that Lightning has.
Yeah, I think, was it force close? I think it said like, I was looking at the Phoenix documentations and basically just says if you force close, it's like 5 day or... After a 720 block delay, they'll be moved back on chain. So it's a lot of blocks, especially
because
they don't always come that quickly. But
true,
But yeah. One thing I will throw a little prop to Lightning's topography, I guess, which like the problem with Lightning is people built some interesting system due to these constraints, these parameters. And then they shoehorned it into some use case that didn't work. And now that the use case is like not working super well, I think a lot of like dev time and innovation stuff might be just sort of left by the wayside. So that's unfortunate, because one thing that is interesting about Lightning to me is the actual, first of all, the fees tend to scale with the payment. So if you want to make a micro payment, you want to make a tenth of a cent, you may take might pay a hundredth of a cent or less, you know, so you could make very, very small payments. But also the throughput is not global, and that's the problem with it. But the good part about it means
it's the problem and the solution, right?
If the three of us are, if the two of us and a friend are all transacting between each other, like say five of us, and we're just heavily like no one else knows that's going on, they don't have to experience that, whereas a blockchain is a global database and just the whole network sees it.
I think honestly I've always so I'm a software engineer by trade, and so I find things like Lightning really interesting. Lightning is essentially trying to solve like a very legacy, what's called an NP-hard problem, which is essentially finding the most efficient route in a node graph between any two nodes, and trying to optimize for the lowest cost or highest rate velocity essentially between those. And like from an engineering standpoint, Lightning is truly really cool and really interesting, but it hasn't proven functional, and that's partly because of how difficult that problem is, and the technical, you know, aspects of Bitcoin itself are a massive limitation on what they can do with a Lightning network built on top of that asset. I would be really interested to see Lightning built on top of a network that could properly handle the throughput, right? That could that could serve as a base layer for something like Lightning Network, and whether that's a Bitcoin Cash or Nano or Dash or anything else, you know, Litecoin, anything. And I know Litecoin has had its own Lightning network, but seeing it would be really interesting to me to see the Lightning network built on top of something like Nano, where you have zero fees and nearly instant full settlement, because I think we potentially could, if we ever needed to, use that as a solution for global scaling where if you, as long as you can, the channel management process is feeless and nearly instantaneous, and there's a good experience built around that, I think it could be a decent solution. The problem is inherently the Bitcoin that's underlying that network, and how terrible of a user experience you get because of that, of Bitcoin being the base layer for that. So I hate kind of dogging on Lightning as a general concept, because I think it is a really interesting concept. It's a really interesting engineering problem that they've put some brilliant minds on. It just kills me that it's built on top of such a terrible base layer is the most significant problem. I think there's a lot of other, like, even if it was built on top of Nano or something similar, it would still have a lot of issues that need to be solved.
Yeah. And
there's still a lot to do there, but it would be far more viable built on top of something like that than it is built on top of Bitcoin.
Yeah, the thing that's really, that I wonder if it could be figured out, is the problem with Lightning is the big restriction is the two-way multi-sig thing. It's not even a bunch of people. It's just two people.
Even with two people, yeah.
You stitch together tons of two people, so there's all those like very small like liquidity constraints. Yeah. If you had like a, and I think this is actually like a Lightning roadmap kind of a thing, like where people talked about doing this, where you could have a group, like I think a channel factories might be what it is, where you start to open, you group open a whole bunch of channels in one transaction. Now there's trust issues from that, but like imagine if instead of doing, if every time someone joined Lightning, they joined the same channel, the same pot or whatever, for example. So you wouldn't have to have all these little teeny siloed pieces of money that then you try to run into problems. But then the transactions would still scale by connected node, right? Where you, where if I only transact with you and someone only tracks that, like wherever the path goes are the only nodes that even need to have any exposure to the transaction data being sent across. Something like that, if you could do that without those constraints, it might be an efficient second layer. But as it is, it was designed with the artificial design constraints imposed on it by decisions on the base layer. And that's the right. That's where you run into some of the more frustrating issues with it.
Yeah, it's completely constrained by its base layer, essentially. I think there could be some really cool things to come out of the Lightning network technology. I just think we need to see it built on top of something more functional. And I do think, you know, something like what you're talking about potentially could be feasible. And I think the scenario you described where, you know, you have a few friends that you want to be able to basically swap back and forth with without having to necessarily use the base layer, especially if we get to a point where any network becomes a global standard, we probably will need stuff like that. So I think the technology itself is promising. I think, you know, NFM multisigs, things like that do, like you mentioned, create a lot of concern over trust of others that are involved in that signature. So like massive channel factories, channels with groups controlling that. I don't think that's a good solution long-term. But I think we could probably, I don't want to say that Lightning has been a completely wasted engineering effort. I guess I'll put it that way. I think there's a lot of potential for it still in the future with other base layers and other improvements to the technology itself. Because there's been, I mean, we've had some amazing minds working on that for 7 or 8 years now, at least.
Yeah.
So there's been a lot of really creative things that have come out of it. A lot of edge cases that had not been considered before that have now been considered and accounted for within technology. So yeah, I'm hopeful for its future. I don't think it's viable on top of Bitcoin as it is today. But I think there's a future for it in some way, whether it's some other distant kind of evolution of it or something completely different, but that takes a lot of learnings from Lightning, one or the other. I think it's got some kind of future. It's just a kind of a matter of how we apply it properly and what kind of experience we can, you know, what kind of good user experience we can build on top of it. Because I think the user experience is probably the biggest hindrance to it today. Anything else you want to cover today?
I think that's good. It's a good place to wrap this whole thing up. It's cool. I looked at speaking of, you talk about the Discord. That reminds me. I almost forgot that thing.
Go for it, yeah.
So something that, oops. Actually, I jumped the gun on that. But so what I did, and unfortunately, I had I have to get my Discord back in working order, but I think it should be working fine. One thing I do is I talk about proof of work and stake. well, the proof of work way of getting, because it's an exclusive Discord that I run. It's just for, you know, subscribers of the channel, paid subscribers and stuffs. And so the way you pay, you buy an NFT. But the other way, the proof of work, is you come on my show. So everyone who comes on my show, I offer them. I stopped doing this a lot because people just were like, I don't want it. But basically, you officially are presented with, yay, an NFT, the Digital Cash Rundown guest NFT that does, the NFT itself will get you into the Discord. You sign with it and it lets you in. I do them on Polygon. And so at some point I might do Arbitrum instead. Again, here we go with the whole L2 fragmentation problems. But if you do have like a MetaMask or a XDeFi wallet or one of those signy wallets that can sign stuff that supports Polygon, just shoot me an address and I'll send you one of these. Awesome. And then you get in. So, yeah. So now it's chill o'clock. Oh, shit. Look at the time. It's chill o'clock. I'm going to put your Twitter account up or X account up on the screen. Anything else you want to shout out, just let me know and go for it.
Yeah, no, I'm good. Thank you for having me on. Yeah, like I said, this is just a hobby of mine, to be honest. And I'm a software engineer. I enjoy talking about the stuff. And I'm obviously more on the technical side of things. Just want to thank you for having me on.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thanks. It's been a pleasure. And yeah, we'll have you on again at some point. Hopefully we get the NFT going by then. That'll be fun. Awesome. As I rebuild this whole thing from the ashes. So anyway, thanks everyone for watching. This has been episode 144 of the Digital Cash Rundown. Go to Coin ATM Radar to check out their ATMs and stuff. I don't know if I should show them at the end or not. Might as well. But now, yeah, as we wrap up, I'm just going to play the outro video of the Does Everyone Need to Run a Node video, which you should watch the video itself. But the outro is just the money shot, as it were. So I'm just gonna hit that up. And on the way out, thanks for everyone for watching. Have a good weekend, and I'll see you guys around. Enjoy.
Thanks, y'all.
But really, if you make everyone able to run a node, it can't be that bad, right? What's the worst that could happen if you prioritize for that? Ready? Go! Both Bitcoin and Ethereum leaders have prioritized everyone running a node. As a result, both networks have seen an average transaction fee as high as $200. Lightning wallets, even centralized ones like Phoenix, are getting too expensive to use. So people are tricked into using Liquid instead, which is a permissioned federation that, oops, you need permission from their companies in order to withdraw. Users also go to fully custodial Lightning wallets like Strike and Wallet of Satoshi, which, oops, just started censoring US customers. Oh no! No decentralized payments anymore, sorry. Only store of values left, right? Dollar cost average. But wait, oops, you could pay hundreds or thousands of dollars in fees to self-custody. So maybe just leave it on exchanges. Except remember this guy? Oh no. Well, he was a shitcoiner. Just use a Bitcoin-only exchange. Ah! Decentralized money is gone. Just join every influencer and post ETF, ETF, ETF. It'll make us all rich. Long Bitcoin. Damn it, Gary. We thought government would save us, not wreck us. Satoshi is rolling in his grave. Not you, Craig.